Let me thank Bianca and Benjamin for organizing this wonderful conference. I'm having a lot of fun and I learned a lot, especially in the first talk this morning. Now I'm going to talk about Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithms, where all these beautiful ideas about how to parallelize your code and write efficient code are extremely hard to implement. But this is an introduction, and it's kind of an introduction for quantum gravity, so I'm going to use examples from my own work on CDT, causal sets, and so the first thing I'm going to do is actually tell you a bit about what is Markov chain Monte Carlo, what do we want to do with it, why is it especially interesting for physicists and doing quantum gravity. Then I'll tell you about the algorithm, and especially I'm going to walk you through the algorithm a little bit with two examples, one very simple one and one that is actually a CDT problem a bit. And then I'm going to talk a bit about what things you measure in a Monte Carlo algorithm, what you have to take care of, and a bit more practical advice in case any one of you wants to go away and start implementing their own Monte Carlo simulations. So let's start with what is actually Markov chain Monte Carlo. I have aimed for an audience that has not much experience with computers. I hope that is right. If this turns out to be too trivial, then I'm very sorry. Okay, so why do we use Markov chain Monte Carlo? What can we do with it? Well, the idea is that we can explore the configuration space. If we have a discrete system, a discrete gravity system, then no matter how many points we actually include, it's actually a huge configuration space, even for relatively few points. One example would be in causal sets, the number of configurations that are possible with n points goes like something like n factorial, I think. We need to find global minima in this configuration space. We need to find out what is the most likely points for our configuration to be in. And we want to calculate observables. That's, I mean, it's still physics. We want to predict some things. We want to find something about it. So if we want to give a very short introduction to what is Markov chain Monte Carlo, then we'd say it's a method to generate an ensemble of states with a given probability distribution. Each state is generated from the state prior to it by some move. And we're going to talk about moves a little bit too. So what do we need if we want to implement a Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm on our problem? The first thing we need is a state of a space of states. That would be in CDT, you have the triangulations or higher simplexifications, these discretizations. This is an example for four-dimensional one. This looks smoother than it actually is in reality. And this space is just the gluing together of simplices according to certain rules. And we know that all geometries that are part of the CDT path integral are made up of these summed together simplices. And we need to find which configurations in this space are most likely. This is a space of states for a causal set. This is a little three-dimensional causal set. And the space of states is all possible relations between these points in the causal sets. So when we have a space of states, that is our physics in some sense, the next thing we need is a probability for the state. So e to the minus si, with s being the action. So we need to have some kind of action as a weight on our geometries. And that's also where a lot of physics happens. The next bit is the move on the state space. That is not physical. We can use anything, and you can actually think very, if you think well about it and come up with a good move, that can be very important. One thing in CDT, usually you use the Pachner moves, where you just change one triangle, one simplex in a certain way. But it turns out that especially close to the phase transitions, that is very slow, and you can come up with better moves how to do it. Sometimes funny things happen when you try to come up with better moves. There's this idea of generalized causal dynamical triangulations, where actually the foliation is relaxed. This came out of an attempt to make the algorithm more efficient by relaxing some conditions and by improving the moves. Turns out the code is slower for this generalized class, but it's a different, new, interesting class. In causal set theory, the moves are very simple. You can just remove or add links between points. But again, that is a very small move, and so you're not moving very fast through the configuration space. And Something that I've been doing recently is Monte Carlo simulations for non-commutative geometry, where the move actually is just addition of some random matrix, which makes it very simple and very well-behaved in some sense. So if we have these things, we can then use our move to move through the configuration space according to the probability distribution. And that is the overall idea of what we want to do. Of course, in detail, it's a bit more complicated, and that's what we're going to go next. So I was saying Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm. The Monte Carlo is just how you call these random integration methods. And what is a Markov chain? Well, a Markov chain is a memoryless sequence of random variables, and each step only depends on the current state. So that is what we generate through our moves. We generate a Markov chain. From each state, we go to the next state, and the probability to go to the next state only depends on our current state. So the state that we were in 2 steps away, or 3 steps, or 100 steps, has no influence onto what we do next. So it's without memory. And this is just a little example of a Markov chain where the probability what we do only depends on where we are. Okay. So we can use the Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm then to solve the path integral on the computer. I mean, normally we have the path integral. I have here for convenience already big rotated. So actually I'm talking about a statistical physics system, not about a quantum system. So we just do the path integral over all field configurations, or if we want to calculate an observable, then we do the path integral over all field configurations with that observable in here and divide by the partition function Z. And one way how we do these things is kind of normally Feynman diagrams. We do a perturbative expansion in these, and that leads to Feynman diagrams. But there are many things that are non-perturbative. Like in quantum gravity, these perturbative things don't work very well. So what can we do better than a perturbative expansion? Well, the first simplest idea is let's discretize it. Let's just sum over a regular set of field configurations. Let's pick fields at integer distances and just sum over all of them. The problem if you were doing it like this, if you just sum over a simple discretization of the field, is that most of the states that you sum over are probably states of very, very low probability. Most of your contribution will come from very few states with high probability. Think of it like a statistical system at low energy. It'll mostly sit in the ground state. So if you take a sum and sample over all kinds of states, the probability that you are sampling the ground state is low. The probability is high that you're sampling a lot of other high energy states that almost don't contribute to your state sum at this point. So we need to do somehow better, and that's where we start with the Monte Carlo algorithm. What the Monte Carlo algorithm does, the Markov chain does, is we generate these field configurations that we sum over, and we generate them with the probability distribution Z minus 1 e to the minus s. So if we generate them with this probability distribution, then the sum over observables actually simplifies. We don't need to take the probability into account anymore. We can just sum, because this probability and that probability kind of cancel each other out, and so does the state sum. So we just need to sum over the observables that we have measured along our state space. And then we're sampling the regions roughly according to their probability, and therefore our sum will converge much faster. And you can prove that if you had an infinitely long Markov chain, then you would certainly converge to the right average for the observable. So now I'm going to tell you about how we do in practice the algorithm, and I'm going to walk you through my examples. So if we have the algorithm, we start somewhere at some point in our state space, and then we need the transition probability to go from this state in the space to some other state. So we can split the transition probability into two different parts. One is the selection probability, G, from phi to phi prime, that is basically given by the moves. The selection probability for me to go from here to there will just be the probability for me to do that move, and that will be given by which moves we are using. So the selection probability is actually in practice something that is dependent on how close states are. Usually you choose it so that you can only move from one state to another state that is in some sense close to it, that you only make a small change. Because if you have a small change, you have a better chance that you end up somewhere that the probability is still relatively high. If you make a large jump, you might just go from somewhere where you have a high probability density to a very low probability density, and most states will be low probability density, so you won't move very efficiently. Instead, you only do these small steps, and that's, as Eric said, it's the Pachner moves in CDT, in dynamical triangulation. You only make a small change, and because it's a small change and on the whole thing, it's inefficient in some sense. The next part is the acceptance rate. We adjust the acceptance rate to fulfill a certain condition called detailed balance, about which I'll tell you on the next. So we can adjust the acceptance rate in such a way that the transition probability overall fulfills detailed balance. Well, what all do we want from this transition probability? So it can only depend on phi and phi prime. So that is the Markov condition. We only want dependence on our current state and on the next state, which is going to be in the acceptance rate. We want the transition probability from phi to phi prime overall to go to 1. So from this state, we have to go to some other state. Actually, phi prime could also be phi itself, so we can have a staying probability in there. But yeah. We need the transition probability to be ergodic, so that if I start out from one state, I need to be able to somehow reach each other state. I need to be able to explore my entire configuration space. If my moves don't allow me to explore the entire configuration space, of course, I won't get the right result because there's some part that can't be sampled. We want the probability distribution to converge, which happens because of detailed balance. And here I already said that we pick the transition probability so that it's only non-zero if we move between states that are close to each other. This is the detailed balance condition that I already mentioned. Detailed balance is important because under the condition of detailed balance, we can prove that the probability condition will always converge in the large n limit. So we have detailed balance, so the probability to move from phi to phi prime has to be the same as the probability to move from phi prime back to phi. So it's... Yeah, phi, no, these p's are given by the probability distribution, which is this. So the probability to move from here to there and from there to here has to be...
So the condition is the first one.
Yes, that's the condition. And so we want the probability to move between them to be proportional to the energy difference between them in some sense. And to fix this, we have... One, the move probability, which we have the transition probability, the move, so where we can go, that is fixed by which moves can we use. And then we have the acceptance rate, which we can adjust in some way to fulfill detailed balance. So we can choose the acceptance rate so that everything behaves correctly. And how to choose it that way is what we're going to do in our examples. So one algorithm in particular is the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm, and that's the algorithm that I in practice have always used and that I'm also going to use in my two examples. So we just generate the new state phi prime according to the move probabilities, and then we automatically accept the new state if the probability of the new state is higher than the old state. So we always move if we go from somewhere with higher energy to a state with lower energy. And then, if we move from somewhere with low energy to somewhere with higher energy, we will accept it with a probability proportional to the ratio between the probabilities. So we can still move from low energy to higher energy, but the probability to do that is lower. And I will show you why we need that in the little example with Monty the Monte Carlo monkey. So let's say we have the monkey sitting here at the top of his little island, and he wants to go to the low, to a low point on the island because low points have the highest probability of finding bananas. He's moving very simply. The probability to move to a new point is 1/2 if it's the point next to him, and he doesn't make any jump that is longer than 1. So the probability to go from I to I prime or from I prime to I is exactly the same. So we only need to adjust the acceptance ratio, and the these probabilities will cancel out. So the first idea you maybe think is, well, why don't we say he always accepts a move to lower probability, but if the probability is higher, we don't even bother. We just, I mean, it's lower probability, it's higher probability, no, sorry. We always accept lower energy and higher probability. We don't accept anything that leads us to somewhere with higher energy or lower probability. What happens is he does the first move. He randomly moves in this direction. Now he's stuck here. The probability is higher than where he was before, so he'll never move out. But the overall probability for bananas is still a lot lower than the best probability he could have. So that is why we need to have the acceptance rate to be either 1, if the probability is of the next move is better than the probability of the place where he's right now, or else it's proportional to the proposed probability divided by the current probability. So if the proposed probability is lower, we still have some probability to move, and especially we have a probability if we're moving somewhere where we move around the lowest energy state a little bit. And then, say, the next move was here, and then he's going down here, and he has the best probability for bananas. But he'll still, in the future, move about a little bit, jumping up and down, and so probing these other states according to their probability, so that we'll overall roughly map the right probability. I've also got a bit more complicated example. This is an example for a very simple CDT triangulation. We'll use the so-called 2-to-4 move. So we take these two triangles and we turn them to 4 triangles by adding in a vertex in the middle. On the computer, we always work with label triangulations. That comes out because you need to label them to put them on the computer, and it's a lot of extra work to remove labels. So that's actually... there are people that think about labels as a bit of a choice of gauge, and you can have very long discussions about that. So we move from these two triangles to 4 triangles by adding a vertex in the middle. Now, how does this move work with the probabilities? Well, we have... the number of triangles we have is always twice as many triangles as we have vertices. We can see that by just saying that for each vertex, we have 2 triangles adjacent to it. So now the probability for our triangulation is 1 over z, 1 over n factorial t. That's to remove the labeling. And e to the minus lambda times the number of triangles. That's because the action in causal dynamical triangulations in 2D gravity, the only thing you have as an action is volume times cosmological constant. So lambda is like a discrete cosmological constant, and 0 is just the number of triangles is proportional to the volume. Now we want detailed balance to be fulfilled. So we have first the probability to go from one step, from one triangulation to the next. So from one triangulation with n0 points, we can go to n0 new triangulations, t n0 plus 1, because we can put each n0, we can choose each point and then add a new vertex next to it. Now we choose the selection probability, and but we don't really choose the selection probability. The selection probability is fixed through the move. To go from tn0 to tn0 plus 1, the probability to go from one triangulation to a given other triangulation is 1 over n0, because of that's how many points we have where we could add the new point. And the probability to go from tn0 plus 1 to tn0 is 1 by removing the vertex n0 plus 1. So we can choose that this part is 1 because we have picked the vertex. So we can then adjust the acceptance rate. Again, the minimum of 1. So if the probability is higher, we always want to accept. If the probability is lower, we have the selection probabilities and the probabilities of the triangulations. And we find that from tn0 to tn0 plus 1, it's n0 over n0 plus 1, e to the minus lambda, because we have increased the size by 1, so we add plus 1 here. Or here it's e to the 2 lambda, n0 plus 1 over n0, because of the number of choices we have. And then we have adjusted the acceptance rate correctly. And this is something that you always have to think about then. How do you, what are your acceptance rates according to which moves could you make? Okay, and now I'm going to talk a bit about observables and things that we can measure in the Monte Carlo algorithm.
Excuse me, one stupid question. So if I do my Monte Carlo check, I want to compute the next step, and I try direction, the energy is higher, and I'm not allowed to go there. Is the next step in my Monte Carlo chain, do I stay where I am, or do I just try as long as there's one direction in which I'm allowed to go, and that will be my next step?
Oh, okay, I forgot to say that. So you try to make a step, the next step is rejected, then you add the place where you are right now again to the chain. But then you're trying for the next step. And eventually you will move in the next step, because eventually you're gonna propose somewhere where the probability is better, or even if there's, say, I can only go forward and the energy is higher, eventually I will beat the probability. The probability to make the step forward is very, very low, but it is a probability not equal to zero. Of course, if it is extremely low, then my code will get stuck very long in this point.
Yeah, that's the next question. I mean, what happens if probabilities become zero?
They can't. Because the probability is always...
No, I mean, what is if there's regions in phase space where the probability is just zero?
No, the probabilities to do any... Isn't the condition that the probability to do any step from a given configuration to any other configuration should add up to 1?
Mm. Yes, but my question is, how do you cross that region where the probability is zero? So you lose elasticity with this rule.
So what I understand is, you are sitting on a given configuration. Then you say, okay, let's try another configuration. So you try this other configuration. Either it comes with probability 1, and then you go. It can also come with probability, this thing can come up with this transition rate, say 0.7. Then the computer makes a random process and says you go or you don't go. So then actually you're still on this space, and if you don't go, you try again another one.
I know, but what I'm saying is that if you have a region in phase space where the probability P is zero, then by the Hastings algorithm, you don't cross it.
Yes, so I didn't think about places with probability zero because my probability distributions always look e to the minus some action. And no matter how high the energy is, how large the action, it'll always be non-zero. I guess if
but
you...
Isn't the condition that... because that's a Markov... I think that's what kind of a Markov chain condition. I'm on a given configuration and the transition rates to go to all other...
What he's thinking about is I'm here And there's this other patch, but in between here, the probability is zero. The probability to move anywhere from here is non-zero because I can move back, but I couldn't move over there. But then, so if you have something that looks like this with a region where your probability is zero, then you have to have clever moves that allow you to hop over the probability. So,
okay, so is that, so you have to know this about the phase space and you have to adjust, you know, the regions where you can step.
Yes, if you have a phase space where for some reason you have probability zero, then you need to take that into account. But normally in physics, because you always have e to the minus action, it can't. It's never zero.
There's lots of spin from amplitudes which have, I don't know, value zero, for instance, in examples. So,
okay.
I don't know.
Okay, so then for those, you'll need to think about it harder, how to... what exactly to do there, how to avoid this, how to allow it to jump between them.
And usually, okay, there's this ergodicity, you say, so minus probabilities, you can go from every point to any other point. Mm.
Right, yes. My point was that that doesn't allow ergodicity.
Yeah.
Exponential minus S. Yeah.
Yeah, so yes, you can get stuck, and that's actually what I'm going to talk about a little bit on this slide now, because well, if you start out somewhere, anywhere, say my monkey starts out at the top of the hill, then we need to move, and actually our simulation is only good once we are in the region where things behave thermal, where we are close to the minimum. So we start out somewhere in the room and we need to wander around until we have probed enough of the space and are close to the equilibrium distribution. And so the gold standard to check that your code is actually thermalized is by starting from several different initial configurations. This bit of code is from a causal set simulation I did at some point. We started out as very different configurations. They all had a very different energy. But after only two steps, they were two sweeps. They were very well thermalized. A sweep here is like n square steps, roughly. So we have roughly attempted one move on every point. So the thermalization is good if from different initial configurations you have gone to the same place. If you haven't, then you know that it's not good. Of course, this requires that you can find what are good initial configurations. You need several initial configurations. And for something like this, where you need to move about, if you have chosen all your initial configurations in here, but actually the best point would be in here, then you still won't be sure that you have good thermalization. Because you might never have probed in here, so you wouldn't know. So you need to be careful about choosing smart initial configurations so that you can find everything about the thermalization. This, of course, means that you need to run your code several times in parallel, which can be expensive. So you can do something that is a bit easier on the computer. On the other hand, you better be sure that what you're doing. You can just look at how the observables behave. And when all observables have roughly settled down into something that is constant, then you can think, OK, I'm probably thermalized. Of course, if you do that, you might get trapped in a local minima. And you can see this is. The monkey will move out eventually, but the probability that he does is very, very low. So we will hang around here for a very long time before moving to the best banana patch. So the next thing is that when you analyze your data, when you have your Monte Carlo data, what you need to look at is actually not every point that you measured is independent. So that is good when you calculate your average observables, because the points in total follow the probability distribution, so you have more contribution from points with high probability, so your average is very good. But to calculate what is your error on the observables, you need to take extra care, and you need to take into account the autocorrelation. Successive steps are strongly correlated. And to show you that, I've taken the energy from some non-commutative geometry simulations. Here you see just 100 steps, and you can tell these are very strong correlated. They are all very, very similar, and just moving through this little bit of the space. Then I look at the next 1,000 steps, this looks a lot more random, but still you can tell correlation between this region and here. Well, 10,000, that looks more steps, more random. And here at 20,000, it's really, really random how they behave. So you somehow need to estimate the outer correlation to make sure that you take that into account correctly when calculating for the errors. How do you calculate that? Well, you need the outer correlation function and the outer correlation time. The outer correlation function is just the sum, so you, it's a bit like the variance, but instead of taking the square of the function, instead of taking the expectation value of the square minus the expectation value of the function, you take the expectation value of function plus function t steps further on minus the expectation value of the function and expectation value of the function t steps further on. So this outer correlation time will fall off roughly like e to the minus t over tau, with tau the outer correlation time, and then you can determine the outer correlation time by doing a fit. If you are past some region of the outer correlation time, it'll go to zero, and then the outer correlation will just randomly fluctuate about. These were n equal 10 matrices, and these n equal 15 matrices, and n equal 5 matrices. And you see the outer correlation is a lot smaller for the smaller matrices, which is, of course. So here we have an outer correlation of about 500 steps, and we have an outer correlation of about 50 steps. And you need to take this outer correlation into account. It's one reason why larger Monte Carlo simulations quickly become more expensive, because not only do you need to manipulate larger things, you also need to manipulate them longer, because your code needs to run longer to have a reliable result. Thermalization gets slower because of the outer correlation, and your outer correlation time gets longer, so you need more measurements taken before you can actually have a reliable result of whatever you're trying to do. That's system dependent. So, I mean, these, the non-commutative geometry things are matrices, they go like n squared. Causal sets have a very bad scaling because it goes with the number of relations possible, so factorial. CDT is somewhere in between. But, so, you need to take that into account. And then I'm already at my last slide before the summary. The question is, what can you measure in a Monte Carlo simulation? What are good observables? Because that's actually tricky. We need an observable that is generally covariant. We need something that we can measure in every bit of our code, every time, and sum it. We need something that we can easily average over the different configurations. So it needs to be something that is inherently global, because you can't define a local point in your simulation, or it needs extra work. Maybe you can add some meta and measure something according to that, but it's tricky. You want something that doesn't take too long to measure, because things can get... So the non-commutative geometry work that I'm doing right now, our observable are the eigenvalues. So this code is actually limited by our observable, because eigenvalue calculations go like n to the power of 3. Everything else in the code behaves like n squared, but the eigenvalues behave like n3, so that is the slowest point in our simulation. So we need thinking of good observables, and we want something that we can physically interpret. So you might find something that you can measure every step, but what exactly that means in a physical way, that's hard. And this is a little quiz, so what's good or bad observables? If we have a two-point function on the manifold between two points, do you think that's a good observable or it's a bad observable?
An observable you need to measure.
So you would say it's a good observable?
I don't know. In any case, you need to measure
it. Well, it's actually tricky because, if you want to fix two points and measure the two-point function between them, you can't do that. You can't fix two points. You don't know what the points are. When your geometry evolves, these points might disappear. What you can do is measure the two-point function between any points of the geometry and sum over all two-point functions on your geometry. You could say all two-point functions with a certain proper time distance, if you have a measure of proper time or something, and then sum over all on the geometry, and then sum over geometries. But then that's an expensive observable.
So this is for geometries, but point function and scalar and lattice QCD?
Lattice QCD is a bit different because your lattice doesn't change.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm asking. That is much easier?
Yes, if your lattice doesn't change, you can pick the points and measure between them.
Okay.
But in gravity, we don't have a fixed lattice, and that makes...
Could you introduce one special point that doesn't go away? Then you could introduce something like a sphere around that point, and then you reduce the number of the domain of the integration should make it much cheaper.
Yeah, you could, that special point, you might include some matter and then measure stuff around that, but it's it requires more work. And if you have the special point, then the special point becomes a special meaning, and that's a question, do you actually want that? Because special point means special frame, might mean breaking of general covariance. Even more than your discretization might already break it. So it's tricky. Now, well, the spectral dimension, is that a good observable? Yes, it's, I mean, everybody measures it nowadays. But
that's a good idea.
So how to do the spectral dimension on CDT? I was planning on having a slide on that, but then it was late yesterday evening and I needed to go to bed. What you do is you just take, you actually take again several random points of your in your triangulation, and then for the random point, you make a diffusion around it. You have a diffusion process around this point by just having a second Monte Carlo, actually having a random walk, and when you return, you measure how long it takes for this random walk to return.
So you. No,
yeah. Oh, the light.
No, it's the blinds. We need to close the blinds.
Oh, it's not the light.
No, the light, the blind is off. Yeah. You can switch it off.
Don't know. How do we?
That's it.
So, is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So, what you do when you measure the spectral dimension is you pick a point at random, and then you have several diffusion processes around the point and measure until they return. And then you don't only take one point, you take several points, because you want something that is averaged over the geometry, and then you average over geometry, so you need to take several geometries in your ensemble. So it's a good observable, but measuring it is something that is tricky, and usually when you measure the spectral dimension, you don't do it during the Monte Carlo run. You wait until you're thermalized and everything is done, and then take, say, 100 geometry out of the thermalized distribution and measure it on them and average over that. So how about the curvature of our geometry? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it's a bad thing if you try to measure the curvature at a point. Again, we can't define the point. It's a good thing, on the other hand, if you integrate it over your whole manifold, and then it will be roughly like your action, actually.
Can you define fields as well?
Yes, you can put fields on your configurations and then measure correlations on the fields and things, but again, you need to somehow average over everything.
Can you calculate the two-point function between two points at the boundary of your manifold?
If you have something with boundaries, you could do that. But in CDT, what actually is simulated usually is, so you have compactified time. And okay, so you have compact time and also compact space. So you have an S3, and that S3 is compactified, and S3 and cross S3 cross R, and R is compactified.
So for the question is that for convenience, could you just put
yes.
A compact space that is a thing.
So this is convenience. There are some results by, I always forget his name, it's a student of Steve Carlips, who has done some simulations in CDT without the compact time, and it seems to agree. So you could then have boundaries, but still on the boundaries you don't really have fixed points. I mean, you can include fixed points, and you include can include a mass line or something, but again, it's how do you... Everything you fix means it's not part of your path integral, so So what CDT measures a lot is the three volume and time steps. This is, of course, a CDT thing because you have these fixed time foliation. So you can measure at the time step. But actually, what you find is that if you have CDT, I mean, you have compactified time, so this block that forms with a center at T0, this T0 will actually be shifting around. So at some point, you have the center at T0 equal 10. Somewhat later, you'll have it at 20, and it'll move around. So to actually do the average over them, what you need to do is center the configuration around T0. And that is when you get these pretty ADS plots that...
So what's T0?
That's just the center of your volume distribution.
Nothing to do with time?
Well, I mean, it is the center in time steps. So maybe I should have talked... So in CDT, what you do is you foliate in time, and then you have the three volume in time. And these three volumes distribute according to something that looks a bit like a Euclidean de Sitter, and that has a center at T0. So you need to mix that up. So in causal set theory, you might want to measure the size of the maximal antichain, but that's really difficult. Antichains are hard to define, are hard to measure. You can't even say at what time step it would be. So antichain is the closest thing to a space-like hypersurface you have in causal sets, but that's not good to measure. And then there's the Hausdorff dimension. Hausdorff dimension is something nice, and it's relatively easy to measure by just, measuring how far away you go from a point.
Do you use sampling for that, or calculate that by actual summation of all
neighbors? You do, again, just some sampling, I think. But I'm not actually sure how people have implemented that in different, because I think people have their own ideas. Okay, so we're at the summary. So Markov chain Monte Carlo, we have a sample space of geometries generated according to our probability distribution. We know that it converges for an infinite process. So for our finite process, we still can't be sure, but we know that if we would go long enough, we will always converge. And we have a small change that moves us from configuration to configuration. And my practical advice, you need to check your terminalization to be sure that you are actually converged. You need to check for your autocorrelation to take that into account when calculating the errors. And you need to find good observables. So what can you actually measure globally? How can you make something globally covariant? Because you don't have fixed points. You can't just decide to say you measure everything around a point. And thank you for your attention. And here's a little list of literature if you want to look into more detail. Thank you.
I have a question. That's what you start, right? So what are there any questions?
In two dimensions, if you try to calculate a two-point function or three-point function, I know that you typically don't use the triangulation or quadrangulation, you use the Schaeffer's bijection that gives you, so it's a bijection that gives you a tree, and the tree records the distances of the triangulation.
Yes.
So this way you can do the, you can calculate analytically the two-point function, and it's been recently done for three-point function. So I was wondering, I mean, there's also the Hamming-Bajet bijection, that's very simple.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering whether generating those trees with which record the distances is easier than generating the triangulation.
So the thing is, I don't know that these trees actually work to simulate higher dimensional things.
No, it only works in two dimensions.
So in two dimensions, we have the analytic results. So I think in 2D, there's relatively little work in simulations. I'm not sure, for scalar fields on it, they do simulations.
Well, in two dimensions, we only know the 2-point and 3-point functions, but we don't know the 4-point functions.
Okay.
So that could be interesting to be on
things about CDT and the speed of working.
No, the tree projection is actually a CDT thing.
Yeah, so he speaks about DT, which you can also. I'm not sure if it's about DT.
The tree projection is in CDT, right?
No, it's in DT.
It's in DT. But there's also a tree bijection in CDT.
Yeah, but it's much simpler in CDT because you don't need to record the distances because it's foliated. But in DT, it's not foliated. So you really need to record distances along the tree. And then we only know the 2-point and 3-point functions. So it'd be interesting to do the simulation for the 4-point functions. But as you say, it's difficult to record the distance numerically. So that's why I was wondering whether generating a tree instead of translation could be used.
Okay, I don't know. I don't know about this bijection.
Okay. So I have another question then for you. In 3D, you can, in 3D CDT, for example, you can encode a time slice using the midsections.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know a bit about that?
Very little.
So, because I was wondering whether it's possible to generate collection of mid sections instead of...
Okay.
This is about, this is what you mentioned, here you fix the middle of the biggest thing.
Okay.
I mean,
instead of generating the full triangulation in 3D, you can generate the midsections at each time step and evolve the midsections.
Do you mean that?
Because the midsection is two dimensional.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't know.
Sorry. I don't know.
I was asking about whether you can just simulate one slice.
One slice, and then because CDT is foliated, if instead of doing a tetrahedra, a two dimensional thing.
It's like the transfer
matrix.
Yeah, it would be the transfer matrix.
Yeah, I mean, they even do that in four dimensions now with the transfer matrix.
I think
so. So there's some most recent papers with Ambion and Görlich where they do all these things, and using the transfer matrix, you actually get a lot more, larger volumes effectively.
Okay, that's good.
I guess maybe one difficulty is if you consider the transfer matrix, then you have lots of data here, lots of data here, which you need to fix. In principle, you need it to do for any arbitrary triangulation here, you need to fix any other triangulation here. So I guess I don't know the paper, but maybe you have to find a way to kind of have some force main observers, and then you can coordinate pick another H, and it's maybe also very similar to the question which data do you keep fixed or some overall or something.
If you imagine the transfer matrix to be a matrix between the set of midsections, between sets of midsections, then it's a terrible matrix. Maybe it's better to only look at specific observables.
It's been a while since I read
it. So there was a question, Eric? Yeah, so the outcome of the simulation is kind of sampling of the solution space, isn't it? So I assume first you run the Monte Carlo chain until it thermalizes, throw away everything, and then you stay thermalized and just get 10,000 space times or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Usually not 10,000, usually less, but.
You said your system moves around. Is that dynamic the result of your numerical algorithm, or is it a physical thing?
It's not a physical thing. Like, if you fix that you don't have time periodic, then it actually doesn't move that much. But if time is periodic, then it's just doing a random walk around along the time direction, but that's not physical as far as we know.
And then the Metropolis algorithm, it's easy to get stuck in a local memory, which is highly dependent on your initial state. So how do you choose your initial states that you get to the global memory?
That's one of these things where you need to have a feeling for your system. So that it's really dependent. I mean, it might be that it's hard to generate an initial state depending on what you're doing. So that's and causal sets in the things that I've done, we knew about the initial state, so we could do an initial state without connections, an initial state where everything was in one connection, and then some in-between cases to find something that is very simple.
And they all converge to the same global.
Yes, and that's why when we were certain that it's similarized. In CDT, what you often do is actually, I mean, if you have, I think the state of the art is 256,000 triangles, you can't by hand go and glue them together in any way. What you do is you start from something that is a minimal configuration that has the right topology, and then just let it evolve. And it'll grow by evolving because the action. So what is actually happening in CDT? Good, I have an extra slide. We count some of all possible values. So what you do is that you fix the total volume. So the total volume is N4, and it's a conjugate variable to K4. So we decide what N4 we want, and then we'll fluctuate around that because the Pachnamos in CDT generate triangles. So we can tune K4 to its critical value and fix the expectation value of N4 that way. Or we can add an additional volume fixing term. And what happens is you start out from something very small, but then you move towards the correct distribution. And then to start at different distributions, what you have to do is start it several times and hope that it takes different ways. Or you can maybe try from something that's next to minimal and move around. So that's very tricky to come up with initial configurations, actually.
So usually it's very difficult, or it takes a lot of time to climb out of those local minimums, but you're starting from quite different initial conditions and you're finding that you're climbing out these minimums quite easily.
You climb into the same minimum, yeah. Of course, you might still have the bad luck that all of your things take you into one place. I mean, you can never 100% exclude, well, you can rarely 100% exclude that. But, so, yeah.
Now, this basically relies on this e to the minus s form of these probabilities. The amplitudes in twin foams usually are complex. Very often we're lucky and they're real for some reason. Mm-hmm. In the general form, they first look complex. Is there any application for complex functions, i.e. really finite path integral?
No, not that I know of. You'd need to somehow figure out how you can decrotate your amplitudes to get some probabilities. I mean, it's actually an interesting question that I thought about when you were talking about that on Monday, that one should maybe look at if you can use some real probability distribution, but then still sum over the complex things and how that works, how well you then match what you actually should find.
Hmm.
But to my knowledge, nobody has looked at that yet.
Right, are there any more questions?
Yeah, I think I just have a very naive question about if one was looking at that you have some discrete set of moves to move between configurations, can you also work with continuous variables?
Yes, so that's what is happening in the non-commutative geometry things, because there your space of configurations is actually just a matrix space. And then what we do is we add a random matrix, which is small but has continuous values. So you can use something continuous if your system is good for that. It depends on what your state space is. The CDT and causal set state space is discrete, so you have discrete moves, but
yeah,
you could have continuous moves for a continuous space.
Right, if there are no more questions, let's thank these again.